Hello and welcome to Open Minds UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here with Martin Handyman Willis.
That's me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm for hire.
Oh, you are? Are you really?
No, not really.
Oh, okay.
I just thought it sounded good.
Because I know you're doing some work around your B&B, which is some kind of amazing place or something like that.
And yeah, it's never ending. Yeah.
Always something to do.
There is. Could go 24 hours a day, but, you know, I got to sleep sometime.
Yep. Do you have, like, the thing where you bend over and, you know, your pants kind of come down and some stuff shows off? You know, like, plumbers and stuff are known for?
I don't know if I have that. I sure hope not. No.
Yeah. Well, be careful. No. That's all I'm saying. Be careful for that.
Yeah.
I mean, especially you'll scare away guests.
Yeah, I'll have to be conscious, and I'll watch myself from now on and see if I do that type of thing. I don't think so.
What can you do for that though? What I wonder the plumber trick to keep from, you know, that happening.
It's called a belt.
Yeah, well, that'll probably do it.
Yeah, I think a belt should do the trick, I would think.
Yeah.
Tighten it up a little.
Yep. Yeah. All right. So it's good to hear from you again, and my guest is exciting, I think, this week. It is Bill Schroeder, also known as the MUFON Man.
Where's he out of?
I don't know. I don't remember, to be honest, and I should look that up where he lives. I can't remember. He's out of Facebook for me because I see him on Facebook quite a bit. But he's very interesting. He's a retired police officer. And he's now into UFOs. And he talks about how, you know, he's been into it the whole time. But for reasons that we'll discuss, he couldn't really talk about it. And now he's full on investigating in Florida. That's where he's from, Florida. And he has an amazing case that, you know, amazing sighting he had early on. And, in fact, I think he was like one of these star secret witnesses on Coast to Coast at one point where he finally decided to talk about it. And they had him on Coast. But, yeah, we talk about all of that. He's a really interesting, cool guy. And he'll be speaking at the MUFON Symposium later this week.
That's right. That's coming right up. Now, I did meet someone in Phoenix that was involved in MUFON that was also a police officer at one time. So I think that's not that uncommon. There are a couple of them, and I think they make great investigators.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. Yeah. I mean, you can tell, you know, the verbiage that he uses, the analytical mindset, which is, you know, really valuable in doing MUFON investigations. And he's had a great time doing it. So, yeah, really interesting guy. And I can't wait to see him talk at MUFON.
Does he wear plumber's pants when he's investigating?
That's a really good point. And MUFON should have some pointers for their investigator in case they have to check some evidence on the ground, you know, how to make sure that you remain professional and don't overexpose yourself.
Tighten the belt.
Yeah. Yep, tighten that belt up. You know, you got your Mr. Handyman.
That's right.
So before we talk to Bill, let's go ahead and talk about some UFO news. What do you think?
I think it's good, and I'll start off like I usually do. How's that?
That's great. Yeah.
All right. So this is kind of an interesting case. It's a New Mexico witness wonders if a UFO responded to LED lights. Now, this is by Roger Marsh, who wrote this recently for Open Minds TV, and it is a case that happened back on July 3rd, right before July 4th on 2015, and right near Roswell. And this was along Pine Lodge Road, and it was around 9:30 at night, and it was was reported by a woman, and she was with her brother named Chuck. You'll hear Chuck's name. So she was saying, this is a direct quote from her, "We were standing in front of Chuck's pickup truck facing southeast," the witness stated, "Altair and the brightest star in the constellation Aquila and the 12th brightest star in the night sky was a clear vision in front of us. I had tried to focus cam on the area when I first arrived just because there was no moon. There wasn't enough light for the camera. Chuck was sitting on the tailgate of the truck and noticed a single flash to the northwest. He thought it was a meteor coming straight in, but never saw an additional evidence of this. Chuck thought the flash could have been an iridium flare, but never saw any additional evidence of this either." So they, as they were stargazing, in the looking up at the Milky Way, basically, after a few minutes, Chuck said, "I'm going to try something." He took out his remote to his truck grill LED lights out of his pocket and pushed the button on, off, on, off. And he actually noticed that the thing in the sky was flashing back kind of in a response. And so he did it again, and the thing happened again, you know, a flashback. And this kind of reminds me of a number of different sightings that people are saying they're getting a response when they flash a flashlight at it. Or, you know, you hear about similar things to that. So anyway, they didn't think it was a helicopter or anything like that. And what do you think? I think it's kind of an interesting one.
Yeah, it is interesting. And incidentally, I know a woman who has a brother named Chuck who happened to go to Roswell pretty much every year at the time of the festival.
You think it's her?
I'm positive.
Yeah, because it's July 3rd, that was during the festival, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So you're gonna have to talk to her.
Yeah, so it is. In fact, some of my listeners, sometimes I forgot whose show we were on, yours or mine for a second there, but some of my listeners may recognize the name Chuck because this person's been on my show. His sister's been on the show. And if you go to my Facebook, you'll see a picture that I've got of us at Roswell. Quite a few, in fact. So yeah, I'll leave those clues for people to go discover who these people are on their own, because they didn't use any names past Chuck, so maybe they just want their name to be used. But, you know, one thing I'll say here, who knows? It's really hard to say that maybe a blinking – I mean, if the blinking was exactly what you're blinking, that's pretty weird. It is good they used LEDs and not lasers, and I want to tell people, don't use a laser. I mean, you don't know what that light is in the sky. It could be planes. There have been pilots who have been blinded. It creates really dangerous situations. It's illegal, and you could go to jail. So despite what some popular UFO people say out there, don't shoot lasers.
Yeah. No, I've seen astronomers. I've seen, you know, astronomers. I've been in, like, a stargazing situation where they'll take, you know, they'll point it up at the star so you know which star they are. But, of course, they never pointed anything moving in the sky. That's for
sure. So don't do that. So it's great that they use LEDs. And it demonstrates that if this was real, I mean, if there's a real reaction, that the LEDs worked. So, yeah, it's hard to say. It's interesting, though, that's for sure. I mean, this is one of those where you got to really be there probably to completely appreciate it.
That's right. Yeah, so. But there, you know, there have been a few sightings, you know, that real famous Father Gill sighting and a few other ones, Chuck Fultz and the Allagash, that, you know, they all had some reactions when flashing a light. I don't think I'd be so bold myself.
Well, I mean, in this case where you just see something up in a light up in the sky, maybe I wouldn't be so worried. In the case of the Allagash guys, where you see this gigantic orb on the other side of a river, I think that was a case where, or, you know, Travis Walton, where they're close to this big silver-shaped object. Those are things where I would probably exercise a little more caution.
Yeah.
But really interesting. So I would love to be somewhere and be present at something like this to actually witness that and to see, hey, that's exactly what I did. That would be pretty weird. Mm-hmm. Pretty weird. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be interesting.
Did you see the video for the blimp-like UFO over Kansas?
I don't think so. No, I did not see that.
Oh, man. Come on. Jeez. Well, all right. No, this is really fun. This is in Kansas. Abilene is the name of the town. And this was August 4th of this year. And this person, and it's daytime, said they noticed this odd light moving over the sky. They recorded it on video for a period of time. They said that once this one moved out of sight, two more came on, flew by, but they couldn't record these because they were too far away. But the video is really interesting. At first, you look at the images and you think, oh, it looks like a balloon or something reflecting. But the way it moves, it's moving straight and very fast.
I did see this. I'm sorry. I did see this.
Oh, good.
I take that back.
Yeah. Well, what did you think?
It almost looks like a full-on lit, some type of craft. But, I mean, the whole thing is lit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Some people have said that it's a small aircraft reflecting in the sun. I suppose that's possible, but the object doesn't look like an aircraft at all. I mean, it's circular. It's just this point of light in the day. So people have said Mylar, but people have argued, no, those are silver. It would just be reflecting. This thing looks more self-luminous. So there's been a lot of debate. But I think it's a very interesting video. It's more interesting than most. But this is a good one that people should check out.
I think so. Now, has anyone, as far as you know, taken a serious look, like, say, Mark D'Antonio? I know we always bring up his name, but I'm just wondering if he has looked at this and given any opinion.
Not that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
He should. What I think is exciting, although it takes him... It'll be a couple of years till it comes out, is that MUFON Science Review Board reviews all of the best cases. Like, they go through all of them, and then they'll come up with their top 10. I've had Robert Powell on, maybe you have too, to talk about this specifically, and he said that at least one year they didn't come up with 10 good cases. They only had like 8. So, they really put them through a lot of scrutiny. And if these cases are able to come out on the other side of, their scrutiny, those are always good. So it'll be exciting to see if one of these makes their top 10. But, I'm not aware that Mark's looked at any of these. But it would be interesting to know.
Mm.
Because another one, and by the way, we're including both of these in our next UFO report. But another case that I think is interesting is in Missouri. Which I think Debbie Ziegelmeyer is the state director there. Yeah, that's right. And she has a brother.
Chuck?
Yeah. So, Missouri, there's a case here in Lee Summit of a disc-shaped object that was recorded on video. Now, unfortunately, the image... the video was not included, just some images. And this person feels like they did a lot of analysis that this was a disc-shaped object. The images are pretty interesting. And it was investigated by Missouri MUFON. Now, for full disclosure, because I think this should be disclosed if it's the case, and I'm trying to figure this out, I got the sense that the witness was also the investigator. Which taints the investigation a little bit, mm-hmm. because this person feels that they estimated this object to be going 2,000 miles per hour. They used the distance between these two lakes that this person saw this thing fly near, but the The problem there is the distance. I mean, you would have to know the distance and
Yes.
an idea of the size. And so there are some assumptions, I think, being made here. But it is a weird looking object. It does look disc shaped. A bird can look disc shaped
That's right. Yeah.
in a photograph. But this was part of a video. However, we don't have the video to look at, so that makes it a little more difficult. But this person is certainly very interested. In fact, if it was the same person, and I haven't confirmed that, so I don't know for sure, but whoever investigated this closed it as an unknown. But yeah, it's an interesting picture. I'd
Yes,
love
and
to see the video.
they show an enhanced frame, and it does, you know, it looks sort of like larger toward the front and smaller toward the back, you know, almost, you know, like you mentioned earlier, almost like a bird would. But yeah, it's hard to say.
Yeah, and with looking at that picture, I think if you had the video, you would be able to see the flapping motion if it's a
Right.
bird.
Yeah.
And it depends on the length of the video, because, of course, birds can coast where they're not flapping.
That's true.
So it's really hard to say. Too bad there's not more information. But this person certainly was really excited about the sighting, and it is kind of an interesting picture. So that's some things that people should check out.
Yeah.
But
I'm wondering just why they wouldn't post the video.
That's a great question, and really they should. I don't think there's perhaps they felt, oh, I'm also the investigator, so I don't need to because I'm looking at the video. But maybe video is part of the investigation. It's just not being shared. I mean, I think if, for instance, D'Antonio were to look at it, he would have access to the video. Or anybody else who wanted to take a second look at the case, like the Scientific Review Board, probably will take a look at the video. So we'll see what they have to say. But, we'll have to see. I mean, really, it could be that maybe he said some cuss words while he is watching it and he doesn't want that's kind of embarrassing to him. I don't know.
That always seems to happen, doesn't it?
Yep.
During UFO sightings. That's what the beep button is for.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. We'll see. Yeah, UFO sightings. There's lots of cursing and stuff. So who knows? I'm not sure. That's a great question, though. Hopefully we'll find out more. I want to also promote one more thing because I'm really proud of it. And you mentioned you read it and enjoyed it, and I appreciate
yes.
that because I'm really proud of this article I have on astronomers and UFOs. In fact, I do a talk on astronomers and UFOs that's based off of this article. But there was a time where I was doing an interview of Seth Shostak face-to-face, and he said, well, if UFOs were real, you know, astronomers would be more interested, and they look at the sky on a regular basis. Well, astronomers are interested in UFOs. Not only are they interested, really, I think you can argue, and especially using this article, that astronomers started modern UFO research, beginning with Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was an astronomer who worked for the U.S. Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Once the Air Force in 1969 closed their UFO investigations, he continued to do this on a civilian basis. What's more interesting is that he wrote a paper about astronomers and UFOs, and I write about this paper that was classified when he wrote it, since has been declassified, and it's part of the Blue Book reports, and I have a link to a full copy of his report in my story, where he finds that astronomers do have UFO sightings. I think he said about 5% of the astronomers he spoke to said they had sightings, and many of them, he found, interestingly, were open to the idea of scientific study of UFOs. Then moving forward, he was inspired by this article, actually, in 1952, where from Life magazine, that really was a big deal. I mean, this article is huge. It really got the public into UFOs. The reason this article was so shocking to the mainstream and to the public was that two very prominent astronomers were in this story saying they had seen UFOs. And then later on, Peter Sturrock, a I forget what his PhD is in, but he's another UFO researcher some of you may have heard of. He has a book called UFO Enigma. But he did even a larger study of astronomers regarding UFOs, and he found also similar results to Hynek. So, you know, there are astronomers seeing UFOs and interested in UFOs. We have amateur astronomers involved. There are occasionally even now astronomers. I think I end with Derek Pitts, a major astronomer out of New York who is very open to the UFO topic, mainly because of Leslie Kane's book, actually. And wow. So, yeah, so astronomers, there are astronomers interested, Mr. Shostak. Come
yeah,
on.
Did you say when you had him face-to-face, did you bring up J. Allen Hynek?
I did not bring up Hynek. I brought up Sturek. And because Sturek had a full-on book, and so did Hynek, and I figured Hynek's a little older. Perhaps he hasn't reviewed a lot of that. But, you know, I was disappointed because, you know what, when I brought up Sturek, Shostak said he never heard of him and had never read his book. And that's one of the things that frustrates me. Shostak. He, if you haven't heard him talk, and this was a lecture that I had went to, he is a great speaker.
Yes, he is.
So witty. And he's so entertaining. And, of course, he's making the argument for life out in space. And his talks are really good. But it is disappointing that he should choose to speak about UFOs without educating himself, because even a statement like that, you know, is very – it's very loose. It's very sloppy of him to make statements like that without first doing any research. So he really needs to read this report. He needs to read my article. He needs to read this report from Hynek. He needs to read Sturek's book and some others before he – makes these kind of statements.
Well, you know, I think there's a block, a mental block there for someone like him, because it's a different type of paradigm. And I remember when I had him on my show the first time, and we were sort of debating the subject of UFOs, and he's very sharp, as you say, and witty and all that. But I asked him if he had Leslie Kane's book, and he said, yes, but I haven't read it. That was his answer. So, and it's I just don't think that they're interested in, when someone has their mind closed to the subject, they're not going to open it in any type of way to even open a book on it. I really, that's what I see.
I think occasionally, but well, I think that I guess it's, you're right, but it's disappointing because if he wants to be a true, I can see him being too busy to look into it, but he should say that. He should say, I really don't have an interest in the topic. I haven't seen anything that leads me to want to look more into it. These sort of things, instead of speaking knowledgeably about things he doesn't really have as much knowledge about. So, yeah, it's very frustrating.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So, what can you do? But anyways, yeah, I have that article. You could read all about it there. So if you're like, Seth's the man, he told you, you know, read my article and maybe you'll be like, oh man, Seth, bro, you need to
you gotta read
up
this,
on
Seth.
This. Yeah. So yeah. Check it out.
Yeah, it's a great article. I highly encourage the listener to read it.
Yeah. So it was first I wrote it for the magazine, actually. But now that issue 26 in particular is no longer in print and we sold out of them, I'm posting some of the stories there because we put in a lot of work and a lot of research on those stories. So I want to make sure that the public has access to them.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Martin. Did you have any other news you wanted to mention?
No, I got to tighten my belt and go back to work.
Yeah, be sure to do that because you could lose guests.
Customers.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So,
thanks for the heads up on that.
Yeah, no problem. I don't want them to – I know we're talking about astronomy, but that's no reason for them to see Uranus.
You had to go there, didn't you?
I couldn't stop myself. I tried to stop myself, too. Like, one side of me was like, no, don't do it. But it's like, yeah, right. I can't stop myself from that one. All right. Thank you so much.
All right.
And we'll talk to you later. We'll go ahead and let's talk to Bill. I am very excited to welcome to the show Bill MUFON Man Schroeder. How are you?
Pretty good, Alejandro. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Yeah, I know you mostly as MUFON Man because that's what you know is the kind of the name you use online and everything, and I see that all the time.
Yeah, I was very lucky to get that. I couldn't believe it. You know, I put that in as a Gmail address, and it popped up. I almost passed out.
Well, and you, how long have you been with MUFON, and what do you do for them?
I've been with MUFON about 3 years now. I'm a state section director in the Tampa Bay area of Florida. I'm also on the MUFON Star team, and I developed and run the MUFON Mutual UFO Aerial Surveillance Team, the MASS team, which is something that we're working on right now. It's a prototype program.
Yeah, I've talked with Morgan a bit about them. Morgan Bell, who is, I almost said Beall, because I've said Beall for years, and I only just recently heard or found out that it's properly pronounced Bell. But the state director out there in Florida about the program. But maybe can you describe what that program is?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was a law enforcement officer for 27 years, a homicide detective, and I owned my own detective agency for 12 years. And so when I started doing work with MUFON, I went to my first Skywatch, and, you know, everybody was looking up at the sky, and pretty much everything they seen that moved, they were interested in. And being a guy who is serious about surveillance, I left there and I said, you know, we need to take this more drastically and be able to identify what's up in the sky. So I started the MUFON Aerial Surveillance Team, and we dedicate what it is. Basically, we dedicate three times the computer power to figuring out what's up there as we do to looking for it. So it's really neat when we find an object in the sky. We have satellite tracking, we have tracking for aircraft. We also here, because we're on the Gulf of Mexico, we also have a tracking system that tracks ships out in the Gulf of Mexico. So
wow.
we can knock out the things that are known objects and concentrate on the unknowns. It's a pretty nice program.
Mm-hmm. So have you captured unknowns?
We've captured just a couple of unknowns. The thing about that I've learned is that there's so many things in the sky, and really when you start really subtracting the known elements, there's not much that's up there that's unknown. But the unknowns are really cool, and we're also I'm working on a new system completely developed for MAST and is something called passive radar, which is going to be really great, where we'll be able to detect movement of objects above a surveillance location. So it's pretty good. It's an interesting program.
Yeah, that's exciting. So I've talked to Morgan and Peter Davenport about that, because I know he's really been pushing to people to get into the passive radar to look for UFOs.
Yeah, it's I really had to rewrite the entire thing. They were using some pretty archaic equipment. What I'm using is actual software designed radios, which are very small and very portable. And I'm trying to do a one receiver system. May wind up going to a two receiver system, but it's on the way. It's going to work. I've actually got it in testing phase here at the house, where I can track aircraft going over my residence. But it needs to get broke down enough so that it's portable enough to take in the field.
Okay, cool. So one of, I actually had you on the show, you may not know, a couple weeks ago. And the reason being is that, or how this came about, it wasn't like a alternate dimension where I entered it and found the you over there and got you on the show. It's actually, well, in a way, maybe. Morgan provided all the audio clips that he used for the YouTube videos, and I've strung all those together and put those together as a show. So we know some about you, but it's fun to talk to you directly. But if you could share with us, you know, the reason I did that is because those were the symposium speakers, and you're going to be speaking at the MUFON Symposium, which is going to be, you know, this year is Monday, so for the listeners, it'll be later this week. What is it that you'll be covering at the symposium?
Well, I'm covering the thing that brought me into the whole ufology interest. When I was a young man, I was 17 years old, 18 years old. I was in Key West, Florida. I was part of the North American Air Defense Command, and I was on a missile base there. And just one night, I happened to be in the control center with all the radars, and they had an alert where a number of targets came into South Florida along the Atlantic coast. And we tracked them for 4 hours, and I got the... you know, being a good scope dope, I could identify almost every aircraft in the sky, including most Russians, because I watched aircraft coming and going from Cuba. And although I envy people that seen them with their own eyes, the opportunity that I had was to study the movement of these targets over a long period and do elimination. And by the time the evening was over, you know, I was convinced that whatever I had been tracking for 4 hours didn't come from here, you know, and I knew they were solid targets. I knew they weren't temperature inversions. They weren't running rabbits. There weren't any kind of electronic interference. These were actual vehicles, and that's it, you know.
Did they make any strange movements?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They the thing that really got me was they were moving maybe just subsonic or, you know, close to the sound barrier, and they were doing right turns and left turns without any without banking. I mean, they would just go in the other direction, then they'd go, and then they turn back the other direction, which is absolutely impossible. I mean, you know, a human being in there would be turned to jello. You know, you just can't do that kind of stuff. You know, so and the, like I say, the advantages. I watched them for almost 4 hours, and. You know, I could sit there and analyze their flight and analyze what I was looking at and know that I wasn't seeing an optical illusion, you know, so it was amazing. And wow. I had to sit on it, of course, through my whole law enforcement career, because you can imagine if I'd come out and then I've been testifying in a murder trial, and some defense attorney said, so did you ever see a flying saucer? You know, so I had to sit on it for a long time. And when I got out and I finally retired, I talked to my cousin Dennis, who shared the sighting with me. He was in a NORAD unit up in Homestead, Florida, and we talked it over and said it's time to go public. And from the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. So with that sighting, like over the years, because that was many years ago. No, that's no, you know, dig on your age or anything, but you know, you've had your whole career, the rest of your military career, your law enforcement career. But over the years, you've probably, I'm sure, kept this sighting in mind. And have you once in a while said, hey, you know, here's a new technology or here's something that you've discovered existed that it could be. And you matched it up and it just didn't work out. I mean, does that process of you analyzing your own sighting continue maybe even to this day?
Absolutely. It continues. Uh-huh. It continued up to like 4 hours ago. I tried to prove myself wrong. Of course, for a long time, Dennis also got into law enforcement, and we would never even discuss this sighting. We would see some UFO show on TV, or we'd hear about a report of a UFO, and one of us would look at the other and say, "Do you remember the night?" And they'd say, "Yeah," and that was it. We called it the night, you know, but. But I, as different things got declassified, I jumped on them. You know, like they've declassified the SR-71 flight records and the aircraft that led up to the SR-71, because that was always on my mind. Well, you know, even though there was four targets, you know, maybe they were some kind of SR-71 variant, but the SR-71 wasn't flying yet, so you can take that off the list. And then, of course, a lot of the investigation was after I... started working, you know, I started working with NICAP before I was working with MUFON. I was doing the archiving, and I'm proud to be a member of the NICAP A team. A lot of data, they helped me with a lot of information. I had a sighting from Puerto Rico then at the same time, and then, of course, I stumbled on the Crestview School incident, and these all happened within like 7 days of each other, you know. So there was a massive flap in South Florida, you know, As the can kept getting bigger and bigger, I realized that my experience was just a very small part of a very big event. So that's it's really exciting, and I find new things all the time. You know,
mm-hmm. No, that's what's great is that, you know, you with your investigation background, it seemed like you that's the type of thing you would do. I mean, I think a lot of different researchers, especially the good ones, do that. They re-examine, you know, all of their cases to try to solve, let's say, the cold cases as time goes on. Not everybody does that, unfortunately. Some people stick to, no, it was strange, it was unusual, I'm never changing my mind. But that just speaks to the credibility and the importance of your original sighting is that it has stood the test of time and scrutiny by yourself all of these years trying to figure out what it was.
Yeah, and when I reported that the MUFON, of course, they took it very seriously, and it went through the entire MUFON Science Review Board, and they contacted people in NORAD. And although I, you know, they said, yeah, all the equipment he talked about was correct, the communication systems, you know, I mean, they really, and I expected that. They warned me ahead of time. They said, we're going to go through this, and we're going to really take it apart. And I said, knock yourself out, you know, it's, you know, so I'm very pleased. And of course, I still have. NICAP has become a very quiet research organization. They don't investigate sightings, but we do quite a bit of research. And NICAP was an excellent source. Many of the other NICAP people, researchers, and archivists would send me articles. They would find something that was relevant to my sighting, and they would send it to me. So I've been very fortunate to have people around me that that have helped me with my mission here.
Yeah, maybe you can explain to people what NICAP is. I mean, it's an old organization, and if they're still active, because I think people feel that they're not anymore, but and what the A-Team is.
Well, NICAP is the National Investigation Committee on Aeronautical Phenomenon, and if you just go into Google and type in NICAP, you'll go directly to NICAP.org. Yes, we still are in business. It was a very big investigative agency, just like MUFON back in the day, back in the late 50s, early 60s, along with APRO. APRO is, I believe, if I'm not wrong, the father of MUFON. MUFON broke out of APRO. But you had APRO and NICAP back in the day, and then NICAP eventually stopped field investigations, really, and concentrated on archival work and digging through the plethora of available military and government documents that are available that nobody's really looked at. And the A-Team is appointed when you spend some time with NICAP and you've contributed substantially to their effort. And, you know, I've done a lot of archiving for them. I'm an archivist. You're appointed to the A-Team, and I believe it was last year that they put me on the A-Team, which, I'm very proud to be a member of the A-Team, and they're an outstanding outfit, and if you want to do some archival work or some historical work, I'm telling you, they have the database there to help you. They have a chronological list of sightings, and it's NICAP.org. Yeah, go there and check it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I reference NICAP often. As I write stories, they've got, for instance, I just wrote a story on astronomers and UFOs. Well, I just added one to the website. I actually wrote it for the magazine a couple of years ago, but I updated it and put it on the website because that magazine's no longer available. But I linked to some NICAP resources and information, you know, regularly because they're a great organization, and you guys do have a great archive. For instance, I think I linked to a picture of the 1952 Life magazine about UFOs, which is a really important one, and also J. Allen Hynek's book, his first UFO book. He was a consultant for the Air Force. And one of the links I use the most is NICAP has they've got Ruppelt's book up, who ran Blue Book, and his book is, I think, one of the most important in this field. So, yeah, great, great stuff up at NICAP.
Well, yeah, thank you. They work hard at it. I mean, they work hard at it. And it's a great group, and I'm proud to be associated. You know, mm-hmm. But MUFON opens other doors for me, though. MUFON is more of active investigations. I get to. MUFON is much more public. Like you say, a lot of people don't even know NICAP exists. But MUFON, I manage the local Tampa Bay area, and we have meetings. I get to go out and talk to people. We do presentations, and I was very proud and surprised to be invited to the symposium. I was really shocked. I'm honored. What can I say?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to your lecture. So when did you first get involved with UFO research? The 3 years ago, or did you get involved with NICAP prior to that?
It probably, my real serious work probably started like 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. Right around the time, I guess it was 1990, I can't even remember, when we went public. My cousin and I actually went public. We were on Coast to Coast AM, I believe in 2010 or 2009. Because Linda Moulton Howe was on a show, and she said she wanted military witnesses. And I said, what the heck? And I sent her a report, you know. And she actually called me that afternoon. I was shocked. And we were on Coast to Coast AM 2 nights later, my cousin and I. And that was really the beginning where we really started getting serious about it. And then I went to my local MUFON, my first MUFON meeting, and we didn't know what to expect. You know, we didn't know if everybody wearing tin hats or what was going, you know, and I met Terry Ling and at that meeting, and was very impressed with the with professionalism of MUFON and the people. And then later on, fortunately, I met Kathleen Martin, who was a good friend of Stan Friedman. And, you know, Friedman had been working on the Russian MiG case quite extensively, and it was easy to tie in the Russian MiG case with what happened to my site, and it all worked out really nice. Dominoes, the domino effect, you know.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you can, as much as you remember, in a nutshell, explain the Russian MiG incident you're referring to.
Well, I went, you know, I had heard about a Russian MiG that they said was shot down by a flying saucer, but I never really followed up on it. And then after Kathleen Martin had gave the information, she went to my presentation on an incident over Miami, and she sent that information to Stan Friedman, and Stan called me. I almost passed out when I heard him on the phone. I couldn't believe that Stan Friedman would be calling a little old Bill, you know. But we talked about the incident, and basically, and I'm going to call it an alien vehicle. I'm done calling it a UFO. We had one of the alien vehicles flew directly over our site. And in the radar business, in the tactical radar and defense business, you have a something called ECM. It's electro countermeasures. It's what pilots use to jam ground radar. Ground radar uses it to jam each other. I mean, it's electronic warfare is what it is. And I locked on this target, and he shut down my entire site. I mean, I will never. I've talked to avionics engineers. I've talked to people from Raytheon, actually, who made the Hawk system, and they can't imagine what they could have used. Of course, you know, their technology is so far ahead of ours. It looks like magic, you know. So they can't imagine. Well. And then when Stan and I talked about the Cuban MiG, I guess he'd always taken a lot of flack over why would a UFO use a ray gun and shoot down a Cuban MiG. Well, it looks like the poor Cuban pilot was just collateral damage, him and his aircraft, because basically the same thing happened to him that happened to me. He locked on the target, and it sent ECM out that shut down his entire electrical system and probably shorted everything out. Now, that's fine for me. I'm on the ground. I'm in this building. All I do is walk out the back door and say, oh, crap, you know. But if you're in a supersonic aircraft and you lose all your avionics and electronics, you probably can't even eject. You know, that thing becomes a piece of junk flying through the sky. And the co-pilot, allegedly, as I recall, said he disintegrated. Didn't say he blew up. He said he disintegrated. And probably what would happen if you're flying supersonic and you lose all your avionics and flaps and everything, all the controls, you're flying a dumpster. You know, I mean, you're not in an airplane. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I actually brought an avionics engineer in from a large commercial manufacturer, and he agreed with me, you know, that that would be a catastrophe. It would be a catastrophic loss of control if you lost everything like that. And the poor guy probably couldn't even eject. He probably didn't even have enough, you know. It was just collateral damage. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Do you remember what year that incident took place?
Yeah, March 1967.
And so you called it an alien vehicle, because you said you're done calling it just a UFO. At what point did you get to that? What brought you to that?
After the young man that was in that that BCC that night. I'm like many young men in the military, you know, you're 18 years old, but you're in charge of millions of dollars worth of equipment, you know, and we were really well trained, and any scope dopes out there or fire control operators out there will know they'll laugh, because you watch that scope long enough and you can tell everything that's up there. It's just by the movements, by the tracks, by the, you know, you can tell what's interference and what's when you're painting a real target, you know the difference, mm-hmm. You know. I mean, at times we locked on the Greyhound bus coming down US-1. It was really funny, but we know what it was. I mean, you know. So I sat there for 3 hours, 4 hours, and when I walked out of the BCC, and everybody's screaming and running around in panic because our whole system is down. And I tell everybody, and this is the absolute truth, I stood there with a smile on my face because I realized that I was probably in on the biggest secret in history. You know, I knew that I wasn't tracking anything that was made here. I knew that I wasn't tracking anything from here.
Mm-hmm.
But as I became older and became a police officer and got that investigative mind that you talked about, you know, I challenged myself. I said, well, let's make sure, you know. So that's why I dug through every archival record. I looked, and I reached a point after I eliminated the SR-71 and all its prototypes and U-2 never go that fast, not even, you know, never. So when I eliminated all the possibilities, there was only one thing left, you know, and I'm convinced it was a manned, controlled aerial vehicle that wasn't from here. So mm-hmm. In my world, that's an alien vehicle.
So, the vehicle exhibited. I mean, you've done enough investigation to realize that the movement of this vehicle, the technology it displayed, is nothing that we had at the time. By the way, what year was that?
1967.
Oh, 67, the same as the MiG incident.
Oh, yeah, it was the same, probably the same night.
Oh, really? Wow, okay.
Same, because last seen, my vehicle, the vehicle that I tracked, the UAV that I tracked, was southbound, headed straight for Cuba. It went over me. It went over me and shut me down, and it was headed straight for Cuba. The time is right. The date is right. It's just, you know, if walks like a duck, talks like a duck.
Wow.
So I'm almost convinced that that was the same vehicle.
Wow, that's really interesting. So what about the possibility that it was someone from the future?
Oh boy, there you go. That's strong. You know, it's very possible. It's very possible.
And the only reason I ask is because, you know, there are people with the theories. In fact, there's a gentleman who wrote a book. You might be familiar with the book about military UFO sightings. I think this is mostly in World War II or in history. And that's what he feels. And there are others that feel that way. But, yeah, just curious if you had thought of that.
Oh, I have thought of everything.
Yeah.
You've got the interdimensional crossing time barriers. Nothing is impossible. As much of a failure as Napoleon was, he had the statement that I pretty much lived my life by. Of course, we have the same birthday, you know, but... Napoleon says that impossible is a word only to be found in the dictionary of fools, and I've always loved that because
that is great. I don't know that I've heard that quote, but I love it.
Yeah, that's You know, so I've always kind of lived by that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my mind is always open to, I personally believe in the intergalactic thing, but the time thing and the interdimensional is just as possible as my theory. So, yeah, that's possible. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to coming back to something that you said earlier, when it came to you not wanting to share your experience while you were a police officer, and it sounds like, you know, the issue of credibility is kind of a big deal to a police officer. And I want to explore this idea because I don't know that this comes up often, and I do speak to police or former police. So when you are called in on a case as the police, you know, witness, your credibility sometimes is called into or challenged by, let's say, the defense?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you can't beat the evidence, you beat the officer.
Mm-hmm.
That's standard. And the problem was that I was very fortunate. I made the right career moves. I went to the right schools. And many of the cases for the last 10 years of my law enforcement career were very major felonies, homicides, major crimes against person. And these are the cases where your credibility cannot be questioned at all. Your credibility is all you have when you go into that courtroom. And I mean, you and I live in a world of ufology, but the average person that sees a officer standing or sitting on the stand and a defense attorney says, "So let me ask you something. Have you ever seen a flying saucer?" And it's a court of law. You know, I'd have to say, mm-hmm. "Well, I seen a UFO," you know, and right away you're going to have a lot of people in the audience going to say, "My God, this guy's a quack," you know? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly why on the book that Jack Roth, an author that just wrote about the incident my sharing of it.
Huh. Yeah, I know Jack.
Yeah, Jack. Well, our book just came out. It's called Unknown Down. I love it. I just read it. And the guy made me look real good in there. I got to give him credit.
Yeah, I didn't know that. He had written a book recently on all of this. So I'll have to have him on. He's a great guy. I really like Jack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, get in touch with him because the book just came out. I just got him delivered today. I'll send you a picture of him. I just got it.
Great.
Jack actually talked to one of my old partners, and, you know, it was 1984, 85, and, you know, and he said, "Yeah, Bill told me about it, but he was so quiet, and he told me never say anything," you know. I mean, so I had to be careful. I had to. And Dennis, my cousin, was in the same boat. Dennis was a investigator with the state of Florida for 25 years. He investigated white-collar crime and that type of stuff, and he was in the same boat, so we didn't even talk about it between us. Like I said, it was always the night. We didn't even talk about that.
Mm-hmm. So. It's interesting because you're the first, you know, former police officer I've talked to who's told me that this credibility issue was a big deal for them. However, the other police I've talked to, you know, didn't do the sort of investigations you did, so it makes sense. These are higher profile. But it's interesting to me also because it's another example of why someone would keep some sort of information like this secret and not share their sighting. And in your example, it was the right thing to do. You should not have told anybody. Otherwise, you would have put in jeopardy, you know, putting these criminals in jail. So, I mean, it's something it was probably a very wise decision of you.
It's just a decision that I made early on, and I stuck with it. I'm glad I did.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like I said, it's not because I'm a super cop. I just got the right breaks. I was in the right place, and I went to the right training. But many of the people that I was testifying against were murderers, you know, major crimes. And I would have left. If I'd have lost a case because I've opened my mouth like that, I would have left law enforcement. I would not have been able to deal with that. So mm-hmm. I just sat on it, you know, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, I think it was the right thing to do. And it's one of those kind of nuances in our society where that people, I think, misunderstand often. And it's one of the things that makes this sort of work difficult. For instance, you have probably ran across people in the last 3 years who want to remain anonymous and probably rightfully should.
Absolutely. I was interviewed 3 months ago. One of the best cases I've ever seen. He was an airline pilot and talked to me under total anonymity. And I verified everything. You tell him his flight, the altitude, where, you know, and outstanding sighting. But he knew that if he went public, it would cost him. As a matter of fact, when he had his sighting, and I'll share this with you, there were other aircraft in the flight pattern with him, and he was sure they seen the sighting, and he reached out to push the radio button or get ready to ask them, and his co-pilot said, "Wait a minute, you sure you want to do that?" And mm-hmm. he said, "You know what? We better not." So, I mean, that's the thing, and other professions, I'm sure, are the same way, you know. And then, of course, you've got all the military guys, you know, they got that secrecy act, you know. If they open their mouth, you know, they can put them in prison. So,
mm-hmm. Right, it's frustrating. For instance, you know, you having focused someone on Puerto Rico, you know, the Homeland Security Puerto Rico case that those guys have investigated, Rich and Morgan and others. The best witnesses or the best expert opinion on the case are these radar experts who work on those systems, those exact systems that were on that craft that captured this UFO. And I've spoken with the guy. I know his identity. I know he's the real deal. But they are remaining anonymous, and it makes it difficult because this is, I think, the best. It's rare that we get expert opinion at that level in UFO research, and these guys cannot share their identity, a whole group of guys, even though and I know for people out there and I don't think it's right that all of these guys do that, but they then disregard that testimony because the experts remaining anonymous. But for journalists, for law enforcement such as yourself, I mean, anonymous sources are not necessarily unusual, and they still can hold some weight.
Yeah, and that's an outstanding case. That's mm-hmm. Morgan brought me in on that in the very beginning and let me look at it because he knows I have a very questioning mind. Our minds work a lot alike. We kind of look at things very carefully. And I actually sent that on to a source that I have that I've used. He's a chief avionics engineer. He's a PhD in flight dynamics and avionics. And he had no idea what it was. He said it's something amazing. But, of course, just like your contact, he'll never come public because it would cost him, you know. But that's an outstanding case, yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, so unfortunately that kind of works. And what a lot of people get frustrated by the people remaining anonymous, but I think that's what's great about your example, is that some people need to and should.
Oh, you're right. You're right. But what can you do?
Yeah. So I want to talk about, you mentioned also earlier some cases that you had looked into that really kind of opened your eyes and led you to realize that your case is just one of many. And you mentioned a couple, and they sounded interesting. For instance, you mentioned about a flap there in Florida and a case at a school.
Well, the wonderful thing about what we call in the business corroborating evidence. Now, when I was tracking my vehicles, it was amazing that when aircraft approached them, they would just disappear off the scope. Now, thinking like a good radar guy, I always told people for a couple of years, I said, the only way that you can disappear off the scope between sweeps is either to go straight up or straight down, either straight up, you know, to 100,000 feet or like straight down into the water, you know. And, of course, I never thought about cloaking or doing something else. So I found the first witnesses I found were actually the morning after my sighting. They were, and I found this in an old, I believe it was an old NICAP file, but a couple, I believe they were newlyweds on Everglades Park there at the south tip of Florida, looking out over the Gulf of Mexico and describing these ships they seen out over the Gulf of Mexico. And what's really neat is that I was convinced, based on the flight pattern that these guys were doing, they were absolutely positively flying a grid pattern. They would fly 30, 40, 50 miles down, then 100 miles across, then 30 miles up. I mean, they were looking for something or mapping, one or the other. Well, when I found this witness, the witness was really funny. He says they'd move real fast over the land, but when they got over the water, they'd slow down, and it looked like they were looking for somebody, something. And this is an independent witness that's seeing with their eyes the same thing I was seeing on the radar. And then later on, we ran into the Crestview School sighting, which, you know, was 7 days after my sighting, but the boys were still in the neighborhood. They actually had almost a touchdown there at Crestview School, and 200-plus kids saw these things. And wow. I mean, it turned into a nightmare for the United States Air Force. And it was investigated by Irv Lillian, who still lives in Miami. And Irv, if you listen, thank you for your help. I found Irv. I called him and talked to him, and it caused him to drop out of ufology. And he was a great ufologist, you know, but the cover-up that he saw in Crestview disgusted him so much that he said, the heck with this, you know. And then Coral and Jim Lorenzen, who were a ufologist from back in the day, APRO, they worked on the case too. And I'm thankful for their work, because I used their research and their book, UFOs Over America, I believe it was, that gave me a lot of data about the Crestview sighting. And then I started digging up newspaper clippings. And there was one witness, his name was Wolf, that was with a bunch of Boy Scouts, and this was right in the Crestview School area there in Opa-locka, Florida, who saw the UFOs vehicles out to his I believe it was northeast, which would be out over the Atlantic. And he said every time that an aircraft would show up on the horizon, they would just disappear. He says as soon as the aircraft left, they'd reappear in the same spot. Well, again, you've got corroborating evidence. There was this eyeball witness that was seeing exactly what I was seeing on radar, except, they were doing the same exact thing, except they weren't flying straight up and down. They were just disappearing. So then we get to the point where they were either cloaking, or they were going through some type of dimensional door where they weren't there anymore, you know. So it's really cool stuff.
Yeah, well, and if you look at the Blue Book, especially the best Blue Book files, we're going to be putting out a video on the 1952 Washington, D.C. sightings. But, again, if you read Ruppelt's book, you'll see these cases over and over again where, just what you described. The radar guys are saying, they're vectoring in the jets, and as soon as they get close, the object disappears. The jets leave or go home, and the objects come back. The Air Force documented this many times. And, I often thought maybe they were just taking off very quickly and coming back, but you're right, there's a number of different answers because they're obviously, or they seem to be interested in one particular area at that time. So cloaking or multidimensional, it's strange. Who knows what they're doing? But you're right in that this is a pattern that's been recorded for many, many years.
Well, one of my interests is military UFO projects, and I actually put up a website for a while, that I was running called militaryufo.org. And it was for anonymous reporting of military sightings by military personnel. I got some fantastic reports. When I started tracking down some of the other military sightings, on many occasions, United States Air Force, United States Navy, or other nations' fighters will go out to intercept one of these UFOs, and the fighter will wind up missing or crashed or never come back, And I don't really think that these vehicles would be hostile. There'd be no reason with their technology. But what occurred to me was maybe these fighter pilots were actually running into these things. You know, they'd cloak and then they'd actually hit them. You know, and there was a Wilbert Smith, a Canadian ufologist who was running Project Magnet for the Canadian government to find UFOs. He actually had a theory of the same lines they weren't mean UFOs. We just had bad pilots. You know, these UFOs disappear, and then the pilot would run into the cloaked vehicle, and that was that. You know, so I don't know. It's just food for thought, though. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. It's big. You know, it is. There are these patterns. Now, what's interesting, what you said about a lot of cases of crashed planes, and it would be interesting to see sort of a list of those, because it doesn't seem like it happens too often, but how many times, I wonder? I mean, how many cases of those do you think, off the top of your head, you can think of?
Well, there was an F-85, and, mm-hmm. and the neat thing about these, a lot of these are the latest technology. I believe it was an F-85. Now, let me see. Yeah, anyway, it was over the Great Lakes. In the late 50s, it was one of the first radar-guided night fighters. I believe it's a Shooting Star. Not sure, but I'm ashamed of myself because I really love aircraft. But it's two-man crew. Flew out to intercept the target that was moving at 500 miles an hour, and they flew an interception course out there, and then the United States Air Force aircraft just disappeared. And then later on, you know, when they couldn't explain it, the United States government said, well, first of all, the target we realized was a C-47 that hadn't logged his flight plan, and then they said that the aircraft just went out there and got lost and flew upside down, flew into the Great Lakes and was gone. Well, you know, there's not a C-47 ever made that's been able to fly over like 250 miles an hour. You know, I mean, it's an old lumbering twin-engine cargo plane, you know. So whatever they were tracking was not a C-47, first of all, right off the bat. And this plane has never been found. I mean, it isn't like the Bermuda Triangle. This is the Great Lakes, you know. This is an Air Force fighter, you know. So I don't know. You know, and then there's two of them over the Sea of Japan. F-100 Super Saber went on an interception over the Sea of Japan and was lost. And F-106, top line interceptor, a few years later, flew into the Sea of Japan, chased one. And you can check these on the internet. You just look up F-106, UFO, Sea of Japan. They're up there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's happening. And, of course, Mantell, you know, the famous, you know, the Mustang, Charles Mantell, who chased, and the stories that they use to cover these are just insane. I mean, you've got a seasoned fighter pilot, they said he killed himself chasing Venus. No, that ain't going to happen. You know, I mean,
right.
You know, I mean, just no way, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that answer is pretty silly. So, yeah, I just wonder how many of these, I mean, it would make a great book too, but, you know, I wonder how many of those are on record. There's probably quite a few. I wonder if you can find a dozen. Even if there's a dozen, that's pretty good.
I guarantee you can find a dozen. Mm-hmm. I've never dedicated myself to it the way, you know, I've got so many balls in the air, as they say, a juggler, you know, but I have never really dedicated myself to it. And the little bit of time I put to it, I found, I think, five or six. You could definitely find a dozen, especially if you started looking into other countries, you know. Mm-hmm.
Funny, and that's how we all are. We've got so much going on. There's several books I'd like to write. I've started one, but it's like just so busy. But the other thing is that another question, and you having this military site up, you may be able to answer is, you know, during a period of time, especially during Blue Book, we had visibility into at least many of the different military incidents that would happen. And we saw these incidents like we described happening on a regular basis, of them chasing these objects and them disappearing. However, once Blue Book closed down and secrecy increased, we now have no access to that sort of information. So I wonder all the time is if these incidents still happen to this day, we just don't hear about them.
Oh, yeah. Blue Book, if you really go into it, in the Air Intelligence Service and the things that they've done, Blue Book was pretty much just a front. I don't think many of the real credible sightings never made it to Blue Book. I have no doubt. One thing that I was turned on to by one of my military witnesses who contacted me, and I checked out his story, and I actually found the existence of a United States Air Force organization out of Andrews Air Force Base called Detachment 10. This is not some stuff that I got out of a mystery novel. Detachment 10 really existed. They were trained by the FBI. They were in Andrews Air Force Base. They flew an unmarked commercial airliner. I got the pictures. I got a few pieces of document with the name Detachment 10 on it. These guys were around. I know they were around a long time. I have a witness that has them at the Bentwaters incident. These guys. So there's something else for you.
But they were some sort of UFO research group.
They're a detachment of the United States Air Force. I think they're a joint services unit. Last I knew, they were at Andrews. I was told where they parked their jet, and by God, you can. It's a white. They used white, unmarked commercial aircraft. Nothing on it. Just a big white ship. The first one I seen was a 707, and it's through the years, And they've been around a long time. They're almost a ghost organization. I found a budget overrun sheet where they got chewed out by the budget office for running a budget over. Yeah, and I found their stamp on a couple of in a couple of reports in Blue Book files. I'm relatively sure that they did exist. I'm very sure that they do exist. They wear plain clothes. They drive unmarked vehicles. I know this from eyeball witnesses in the Air Force. And they might even be the men in black that everybody sees all the time. These plain clothes guys that come and talk to people, and I'll never know. But it's just an example of how carefully they guard this secret.
Uh-huh. And you believe Detachment 10 is still active?
I believe Detachment 10 is still active. Mm-hmm. I really do. That's just a personal. I don't know. I just do. That's my personal feeling.
Well,
I don't know why they would suddenly cease to exist after they've been around for 30 some years.
Well, we're doing more investigation into that ourselves, and we'll be putting out some videos. But to your point, there was, I think it's a Bollinger memo, when Blue Book did get closed, they said, yeah, we can close Blue Book. We've been sending the cases that are of national security concern somewhere else anyway, which just confirmed that, what you said, the best cases were not going to Blue Book. So. And it looks like there were other organizations that kind of been shuffled around to kind of keep information from the public. So, yeah, that's the hard part is we just have little access to what has happened in the last few decades that way. And so who has it? That's the mystery.
Well, it's the problem for them guys is that it's 2016. Everyone's got a phone in their pocket, and someday, these things are machines. And machines break. I tell everybody every time I talk at a meeting machines break, and one of them's going to break in the wrong spot, and there's going to be 6 million pictures of it on the internet before anybody can do anything about it, and that'll be it. It'll be all.
And most of the pictures will be selfies.
Yeah.
With the object behind everybody.
Well, the wonderful thing about a selfie with the object behind you, it does lend some credibility to the object.
Yeah, true.
This, this is me. I didn't copy this from Harry, you know.
Yep, exactly. Well, we're pretty much out of time, but, you know, where can people go to find more of what you're working on?
Oh, yeah. Well, just, you know, MUFON.com. MUFON has, and of course, go to NICAP.org and do some exploration there. I don't hide my email. It's MUFONman@gmail.com. If you want to ask me a question, knock yourself out. I get probably 200 emails a day, and I try to get as many as I can, so don't be impatient with me, but I do answer my mail. And of course on Facebook I am the MUFON Man, Bill MUFON Man Schroeder on Facebook. You know, I don't hide. I'm right here.
Yep, and they can find out more about you at the MUFON Symposium website and by coming to the MUFON Symposium this weekend and seeing your lecture.
Yeah, it's going to be so great to you know, meet these people in person that I've talked to so many times and actually get the eyeballs, you know, what we call in the ham radio business, eyeball QSOs with people. It's going to be so exciting. I'm going to love it. I'm going to be in the vendors area with my book, so stop by and say hi.
Perfect. Great. And I look forward to seeing you there as well.
All right, Alejandro. Again, it was an honor to be with you today, and thank you very much for the invitation.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time, and we'll see you soon.
All right, buddy.
Thank you so much to Bill MUFON Man Schroeder for a great interview. I thought that was a lot of fun, very insightful. It's great to hear from someone who's done law enforcement, and it's great to hear from someone who has remained quiet about his sighting and or anonymous for a reason that is completely valid, for a reason, you know, he should have done what he did. And I think a lot of times we all think, why are they not talking about their sign? They should be brave. You know, he had an important job and he had to get stuff done. And I think it was probably best for him to do what he did. And so that's really interesting. I'm excited to meet him at the MUFON Symposium. And that interview was recorded a couple days ago. I call him Bill MUFON Man Schroeder because, like I said, when I see him online, that's what I see, is that's what he's listed as, Bill MUFON Man. And if you go to his Facebook today, or you will see pictures of the book he was talking about. So it looks like he did get copies of the book, Unknown Down, written by Jack Roth. How strange is that? That I know Jack. I've hung out with Jack. Jack's a cool guy. But it's crazy that it was written by him, someone I know. What a coincidence. But and I didn't know they were working together on this book. But the book looks great. You can go to Bill MUFON Man Schroeder on Facebook and see images of the book that he posted today. And of course, if you're going to be at the symposium, I'm sure you're going to be able to purchase copies of that book. And it sounds like his talk and the book are fascinating, a great case that he was a part of. So very, very cool. Thank you again so much to you, Bill. Good luck at the MUFON Symposium. Safe travels. For those of you who are making it to the symposium, I don't know that open mics we're going to have a table, because it's just going to be, actually, me and my boss are both going, John Rayo, the guy who owns the company and makes open mics possible. So come say hi, you know, come say thank you to John for making open mics possible, and come say hi to me and say, hey, man, you know, I listened to your show. It's great. Or here's some things you can work on. Or I listened to your show once and it was awful, not my cup of thing, but hey, anyway, you know, whatever. Just don't make me cry. I'm kind of sensitive. That would be really embarrassing, especially if you told me right before my talk and I've got to go on stage and I'm crying and I'm like, this guy just told me my show was awful and you know, I do my best. But that would be awful. So I guess just save the positive stuff for before I do the talk to pump me up so I'm all happy. But come say hi. I would love to meet everybody who listens to the show and It's always fun to just say hi to people, some of you out there. So that'll be a lot of fun. That's always one of the thrills of going to events such as this, besides meeting all of my buddies, meeting all the great speakers who are going to be there. So you can go to MUFONsymposium.com to find out more about the symposium in Orlando that's going to be going on in just a couple days. In fact, my boss is leaving tomorrow because he wants to hang out at Disney World for a while. I'm not leaving until Thursday, but because I'll be busy this weekend, it means I probably will not have a show next week. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. But you know what? I've got literally hundreds of interviews in the archives, tons of them. In fact, there was some guy who tweeted me the other day, and he's like, "Hey, do you know of any World War people who talk about World War II sightings?" And I said, "Well, it just so happens I interviewed a man who wrote a book about it." And I sent him a podcast, and he was very happy. So, tons of podcasts that I've got recorded. So, go review one of those. And in a couple of weeks, we'll be back with some more new and exciting stuff. And I've got some controversial stuff planned. So, I'm going to shake things up a bit here. It's always fun to do. So, we'll have some interesting stuff coming up as far as interviews. Otherwise, what cool stuff are we working on? Okay, I told you we're working on this UFO magazine kind of video thing. We'll have that up in a couple of weeks. Of course, we've got the UFO video portal, tons and tons of great videos and lectures up there for a small monthly price. Check it out. Go, come on. Quit being cheap, dude. I mean, you're going to have some stuff there that I don't even have on my podcast because we've gotten people at our conference that won't even do an interview with me on the podcast because they're just that important or just big of a deal. So go check that out. I think I already, if you're not on our email list, get on the email list because we send an email about every other week, so not too often, and it gives you the latest of what we're up to. And if you go to openminds.tv on the right-hand corner, you'll see where you can join. Or if you go to ufocongress.com, you'll see very large towards the bottom of the page where you can register there. But also, we've got about half the speakers at the UFO Congress listed. And here's why. Some of you are thinking, "Oh man, this is my chance to get in. They can't find any speakers." Not the case, actually. We can find tons of speakers, and I've got a great list of potentials. And I've got to weed this down to just a few. So it's going to be really difficult to do. But I guess I could give you, I haven't posted two people, I can give you some information about who will be there. Richard Dolan is going to be. I haven't even interviewed him in a while, but Richard Dolan is going to be there. He's got a new talk that he's created just for the UFO Congress about the UFOs and the media. So why does the media get it wrong? Why do they treat it the way it does? They do. I think it's going to be really fascinating because he's got a special insight into that, being as he's been on a lot of these television shows, and of course he's been following this stuff for quite a while. So that ought to be interesting. And we've also got Noe Torres talking about cowboys and aliens. And this is really interesting because he has done a lot of work researching the old newspapers to find these cases, these UFO cases from the 1800s. We've had him on, we've talked a little bit about it, but his talk's much better because he's got all these cases that he just goes through that are just these really interesting cowboy and aliens cases, really cowboys and seeing UFOs. So those are a couple people we don't have listed that we will. So that's just some special insight for you, the listeners, to have. Other than that, once we go to MUFON, this is the other reason. There's some talks we want to watch and some people we want to talk to. So within a week or two, we'll have the majority of the speakers listed for the UFO Congress. After MUFON, I'll get to work to posting a few more. And then, as usual, we have some surprises in store that are going to take us a little longer to work out. But so there'll be at least a few that aren't listed yet because especially for the more exciting stuff or at least the harder to get or unique, it takes some more time and we have to make sure everything's aligned and ready to go for those. So there you have it, people. Lots of really cool stuff. So go to openminds.tv to see all of this. To do your homework assignment is to go read the Astronomers and UFOs article at Open Minds TV that I just posted a couple days ago. Write that down, people. There will be a quiz. Feels really cliche when it comes out of my mouth. There'll be a quiz. And, you know, that's kind of BS anyways, because I can't quiz you because you're only listening. But it'll hurt my feelings if you don't read the article. Hopefully that will just... You know what else will hurt my feelings? If you don't go watch the interview that I did with Doug Trumbull, that Michael Klein, our video guy, worked so hard to put together, and he did a great job, and it's on YouTube for free, and I'm going to be upset with you if you don't go watch that. So that's your other homework. You've got, there's going to be a couple weeks till we meet, so I don't think it's too much to give you two homework assignments. So you have to go read the article on astronomers and UFOs. It's not that long. You're going to love it. You got a link to, you know, a declassified document about all of this. And then to watch a video, come on, how tough is that? Go to YouTube and watch a video. You push play and you sit back and enjoy. So of Doug Trumbull, the special effects guru and UFO hunter. So those are your two pieces of homework. Before we leave, however, I want to once again thank Caleb Hanks for the opening and close music. It is wonderful stuff. Thank you very much. I want to also thank Martin Willis for being there on the news with us. Of course, he does the show Podcast UFO. Just Google that and you'll find him, and that's great stuff. But as usual, I want to thank you, the listener, for being here and listening and enjoying the fruits of our efforts. It's always wonderful to do this for you and to know there's actually people who care out there who want to hear. So thank you all so much. Until next time, adios muchachos.